Dolphin came sailing up the harbor in that windless summer night, leaning forward, urgent, the mage wind bellying out her sails. Nobody in the palace had looked for the king to return so soon, but nothing was out of order or unready when he came. The quay was instantly crowded with courtiers, off-duty soldiers, and townspeople ready to greet him, and songmakers and harpers were waiting to hear how he had fought and defeated dragons, so they could make ballads about it. They were disappointed. The king and his party made straight for the palace, and the guards and sailors from the ship said only, "They went up into the country above Anava Sands, and in 2 days they came back. The wizard sent out a message bird to us, for we were down at the gates of the bay by then, since we were going to meet them in Southport. We came back, and there they were, awaiting us at the river mouth, all unharmed. But we saw the smoke of forests of fire over the South Falliarns." Tanar was in the crowd on the quay, and Tehanu went straight to her. They embraced fiercely. But as they walked up the street among the lights and the rejoicing voices, Tanar was still thinking, "It has changed. She has changed. She'll never come home." Levanon walked among his guards, charged with tension and energy. He was regal, warlike, radiant. "Aerith Akbi," people called out, seeing him, and "Son of Morhen." On the steps of the palace he turned and faced them all. He had a strong voice to use when he wanted it, and it rang out now, silencing the tumult. "Listen, people of Havnor. The woman of Gaunt has spoken for us with a chief among the dragons. They have pledged a truce. One of them will come to us. A dragon will come here, to the city of Havnor, to the palace of Meherion. Not to destroy, but to parley. The time has come when men and dragons must meet and talk. So I tell you, when the dragon comes, do not fear it. Do not fight it. Do not flee it. But welcome it in the sign of peace. Greet it as you would greet a great lord come in peace from afar. And have no fear, for we are well protected by the sword of Aerith Akbi, by the ring of Elfaran, and by the name of Morhen. And by my own name, I promise you, so long as I live, I will defend this city and this realm." They listened in a breathless hush. A burst of cheers and shouts followed on his words as he turned and strode into the palace. "I thought it best to give them some warning," he said in his usual quiet voice to Tehanu, and she nodded. He spoke to her as to a comrade, and she behaved as such. Tanar and the courtiers nearby saw this. He ordered that his full council meet in the morning at the fourth hour, and then they all dispersed, but he kept Tanar with him a minute while Tehanu went on. "It's she who protects us," he said. "Alone? Don't fear for her. She is the dragon's daughter, the dragon's sister. She goes where we can't go. Don't fear for her, Tanar." She bowed her head in acceptance. "I thank you for bringing her safe back to me," she said. "For a while." They were apart from other people, in the corridor that led to the western apartments of the palace. Tanar looked up at the king and said, "I've been talking about dragons with the princess." "The princess?" he said blankly. "She has a name. I can't tell it to you, since she believes you might use it to destroy her soul." He scowled. "In Hur at Hur, there are dragons. Small, she says, and wingless, and they don't speak. But they are sacred. The sacred sign and pledge of death and rebirth. She reminded me that my people don't go where your people do when they die. That dry land Alder tells of, It's not where we go. The princess and I, and the dragons. Labanon's face changed from wary reserve to intense attention. Ged's questions to Tehanu, he said in a low voice. Are these the answers? I know only what the princess told me, or reminded me. I'll speak with Tehanu about these things tonight. He frowned, pondering. Then his face cleared. He stooped and kissed Tanar's cheek, bidding her good night. He strode off, and she watched him go. He melted her heart. He dazzled her. But she was not blinded. He's still afraid of the princess, she thought. The throne room was the oldest room in the palace of Maharian. It had been the hall of Gemal Seaborn, prince of Ilion, who became king in Havnor, and of whose lineage came Queen Heru and her son Maharian. The Havnorian lay says, 100 warriors, 100 women sat in the great hall of Gemal Seaborn at the king's table, courtly in talk, handsome and generous gentry of Havnor, no warriors braver, no women more beautiful. Around this hall, for over a century, Gemal's heirs had built an ever larger palace, and lastly Heru and Maharian had raised above it the Tower of Alabaster, the Tower of the Queen, the Tower of the Sword. These still stood, but though the people of Havnor had stoutly called it the New Palace all through the long centuries since Maharian's death, it was old and half in ruins when Labanon came to the throne. He had rebuilt it almost entirely and richly. The merchants of the Inner Isles, in their first joy at having a king and laws again to protect their trading, had set his revenue high and offered him yet more money for all such undertakings. For the first few years of his reign, they had not even complained that taxation was destroying their business and would leave their children destitute. So he had been able to make the new palace new again and splendid. But the throne room, once the beamed ceiling was rebuilt, the stone walls replastered, the narrow, high-set windows reglazed, he left in its old starkness. Through the brief false dynasties and the dark years of tyrants and usurpers and pirate lords, through all the insults of time and ambition, the throne of the kingdom had stood at the end of the long room, a wooden chair, high-backed, on a plain dais. It had once been sheathed in gold. Well, that was long gone. The small golden nails had left rents in the wood where they had been torn out. Its silken cushions and hangings had been stolen or destroyed by moth and mouse and mold. Nothing showed it to be what it was, but the place where it stood, and a shallow carving on the back, a heron flying with a twig of rowan in its beak. That was the crest of the House of Enlad. The kings of that house had come from Enlad to Havnor 800 years ago. Where Morad's high seat is, they said, the kingdom is. Labanon had it cleaned, the decayed wood repaired and replaced, oiled and burnished back to dark satin, but left it unpainted, ungilt, bare. Some of the rich people who came to admire their expensive palace complained about the throne room and the throne. It looks like a barn, they said, and is it Morad's high seat or an old farmer's chair? To which some said the king had replied, what is a kingdom without the barns that feed it and the farmers to grow the grain? Others said he had replied, is my kingdom gods of gilt and velvet, or does it stand by the strength of wood and stone? Still others said he had said nothing except that he liked it the way it was. And it being his royal buttocks that sat on the uncushioned throne, his critics did not get the last word on the matter. Into that stern and high-beamed hall, on a cool morning of late summer sea fog, filed the king's council, 91 men and women, 100 if all had been there. All had been chosen by the king, some to represent the great noble and princely houses of the inner isles, pledged vassals of the crown, some to speak for the interests of other islands and parts of the archipelago, some because the king had found them or hoped to find them useful and trustworthy counselors of state. There were merchants, shippers, and factors of Havnor and other great port cities of the Sea of Ea and the Inmost Sea, splendid in their conscious gravity and their dark robes of heavy silk. There were masters from the workers' guilds, flexible and canny bargainers, notable among them a pale-eyed, hard-handed woman, the chief of the miners of Oskil. There were roque wizards like Onyx, with gray cloaks and wooden staffs. There was also a Pelnish wizard, called Master Seppel, who carried no staff, and of whom people mostly steered clear, though he seemed mild enough. There were noble women, young and old, from the kingdom's fiefs and principalities, some in silks of Lorbenary, and pearls from the Isles of Sand, and two island women, stout, plain, and dignified, one from Ifish, and one from Corp, to speak for the people of the East Reach. There were some poets, some learned people from the old colleges of Ea and the Enlades, and several captains of soldiery, or of the king's ships. All these counselors the king had chosen. At the end of 2 or 3 years, he would ask them to serve again, or send them home with thanks and in honor, and replace them. All laws and taxations, all judgments brought before the throne, he discussed with them, taking their counsel. They would then vote on his proposal, and only with the consent of the majority was it enacted. There were those who said the council was nothing but the king's pets and puppets, and so, indeed, it might have been. He mostly got his way if he argued for it. Often he expressed no opinion and let the council make the decision. Many counselors had found that, if they had enough facts to support their opposition and made a good argument, they might sway the others and even persuade the king. So debates within the various divisions and special bodies of the council were often hotly contested, and even in full session the king had several times been opposed, argued with, and voted down. He was a good diplomat, but an indifferent politician. He found his council served him well, and people of power had come to respect it. Common folk did not pay much attention to it. They centered their hopes and attention on the king's person. There were 1,000 lays and ballads about the son of Morrend, the prince who rode the dragon back from death to the shores of day, the hero of Sora, wielder of the sword of Seriadh, the rowan tree, the tall ash of Enlad, the well-loved king who ruled in the sign of peace. But it was hard going to make songs about counselors debating shipping taxes. Unsung, then, they filed in and took their seats on the cushioned benches facing the uncushioned throne. They stood again as the king came in. With him came the woman of Gaunt, whom most of them had seen before, so that her appearance caused no stir, and a slight man in rusty black. "Looks like a village sorcerer," a merchant from Camery said to a shipwright from Way, who answered, "No doubt," in a resigned, forgiving tone. The king was loved also by many of the counselors, or at least liked. He had, after all, put power in their hands, and even if they felt no obligation to be grateful to him, they respected his judgment. The elderly lady of Abea hurried in late, and Prince Sege, who presided over protocol, told the council to be seated. They all sat down. "Hear the king," Sege said, and they listened. He told them, and for many it was the first real news of these matters, about the dragon's attacks on West Havnor, and how he had set out with the woman of Gaunt, Tehanu, to parley with them. He kept them in suspense while he spoke of the earlier attacks by dragons on the islands of the West, and told them briefly Onyx's tale of the girl who turned into a dragon on Roque Knoll, and reminded them that Tehanu was claimed as daughter by Tenar of the Ring, by the one-time Archmage of Roque, and by the dragon Kalesin, on whose back the king himself had been born from Celador. Then finally he told them what had happened at the pass in the Falyrn Mountains at dawn 3 days ago. He ended by saying, "That dragon carried Tehanu's message to Orm Irion in Palm, who then must make the long flight here, 300 miles or more. But dragons are swifter than any ship, even with the mage wind. We may look for Orm Irion at any time." Prince Sege asked the first question, knowing the king would welcome it. "What do you hope to gain, my lord, by parley with a dragon?" The answer was prompt. "More than we can ever gain by trying to fight it. It is a hard thing to say, but it is the truth. Against the anger of these great creatures, if indeed they were to come against us in any number, we have no true defense. Our wise men tell us there is maybe one place that could stand against them, Roque Island. And on Roque, there is maybe one man who could face the wrath of even a single dragon and not be destroyed. Therefore, we must try to find out the cause of their anger and, by removing it, make peace with them." "They are animals," said the old lord of Felquay. "Men cannot reason with animals, make peace with them." "Have we not the sword of Aerith Akby, who slew the great dragon?" cried a young counselor. He was answered at once by another. "And who slew Aerith Akby?" Debate in the council tended to be tumultuous, though Prince Sege kept strict rule, not letting anyone interrupt another or speak for more than one turn of the 2-minute sand glass. Babblers and droners were cut off by a crash of the prince's silver-tipped staff and his call to the next speaker. So they talked and shouted back and forth at a fast pace, and all the things that had to be said and many things that did not need to be said were said and refuted and said again. Mostly they argued that they should go to war, fight the dragons, defeat them. "A band of archers on one of the king's warships could bring them down like ducks," cried a hot-blooded merchant from Wathort. "Are we to grovel before mindless beasts? Are there no heroes left among us?" demanded the imperious lady of Otokni. To that, Onyx made a sharp reply. "Mindless. They speak the language of the making, in the knowledge of which our art and power lies. They are beasts as we are beasts. Men are animals that speak." A ship's captain, an old, far-traveled man, said, "Then isn't it you wizards who should be talking with them, since you know their speech and maybe share their powers? The king spoke of a young, untaught girl who turned into a dragon, but mages can take that form at will. Couldn't the masters of Roque speak with the dragons, or fight with them, if need be, evenly matched?" The wizard from Palm stood up. He was a short man with a soft voice. "To take the form is to be the being, captain," he said politely. "A mage can look like a dragon, but true change is a risky art, especially now. A small change in the midst of great changes is like a breath against the wind. But we have here among us one who need use no art, and yet can speak for us to dragons better than any man could do, if she will speak for us." At that, Tehanu stood up from her bench at the foot of the dais. "I will," she said, and sat down again. That brought a pause to the discussion for a minute, but soon they were all at it again. The king listened and did not speak. He wanted to know the temper of his people. The sweet silver trumpets high on the Tower of the Sword played all their tune 4 times, telling the 6th hour, noon. The king stood, and Prince Sege declared a recess until the 1st hour of the afternoon. A lunch of fresh cheese and summer fruits and greens was set out in a room in Queen Heru's tower. There Labanan invited Tehanu and Tenar, alder, sage, and onyx. And Onyx, with the king's permission, brought with him the Pelnish wizard Seppel. They sat and ate together, talking little and quietly. The windows looked over all the harbor, and the north shoreline of the bay fading off into a bluish haze that might either be the remnants of the morning fog or smoke from the forest fires in the west of the island. Alder remained bewildered at being included among the king's intimates and brought into his councils. What had he to do with dragons? He could neither fight with them nor talk with them. The idea of such mighty beings was great and strange to him. At moments the boasts and challenges of the counselors seemed to him like a yapping of dogs. He had seen a young dog once on a beach, barking and barking at the ocean, rushing and snapping at the ebb wave, running back from the breaker with its wet tail between its legs. But he was glad to be with Tanar, who put him at ease, and whom he liked for her kindness and courage, and he found now that he was also at ease with Tehanu. Her disfigurement made it seem that she had two faces. He could not see them both at one time, only the one or the other, but he had got used to that, and it did not disquiet him. His mother's face had been half-masked by its wine-red birthmark. Tehanu's face reminded him of that. She seemed less restless and troubled than she had been. She sat quietly, and a couple of times she spoke to Alder, sitting next to her, with a shy comradeliness. He felt that, like him, she was there not by choice, but because she had foregone choice, driven to follow a way she did not understand. Maybe her way and his went together, for a while at least. The idea gave him courage. Knowing only that there was something he had to do, something begun that must be finished, he felt that whatever it might be, it would be better done with her than without her. Perhaps she was drawn to him out of the same loneliness. But her conversation was not of such deep matters. "My father gave you a kitten," she said to him as they left the table. "Was it one of Auntie Moss's?" He nodded, and she asked, "The gray one?" "Yes." "That was the best cat of the litter." "She's getting fat here." Tehanu hesitated, and then said timidly, "I think it's a he." Alder found himself smiling. "He's a good companion. A sailor named him Tug."
"Tug," she said,
and looked satisfied. "Tehanu," the king said. He had sat down beside Tanar in the deep window seat. "I didn't call on you in council today to speak of the questions Lord Sparrowhawk asked you. It was not the time. Is it the place?" Alder watched her. She considered before answering. She glanced once at her mother, who made no answering sign.
"I'd rather speak to you here," she said in her hoarse voice, "and maybe to the princess of Hur at Hur."
After a brief pause, the king said pleasantly, "Shall I send for her?"
"No, I can go see her. Afterward. I haven't much to say, really. My father asked, who goes to the dry land when they die? And my mother and I talked about it, and we thought, people go there, but do the beasts? Do the birds fly there? Are there trees? Does the grass grow? Alder, you've seen it."
Taken by surprise, he could say only, There's grass on the hither side of the wall, but it seems dead. Beyond that, I don't know." Tehanu looked at the king.
"You walked across that land, my lord."
"I saw no beast, or bird, or growing thing." Alder spoke again.
"Lord Sparrowhawk said, dust, rock." "I think no beings go there at death but human beings," Tehanu said. "But not all of them."
Again she looked at her mother, and did not look away. Tanar spoke.
The Kargish people are like the animals. Her voice was dry and let no feeling be heard. They die to be reborn.
That is superstition, Onyx said. Forgive me, Lady Tanar, but you yourself...
He paused. I no longer believe, Tanar said, that I am or was, as they told me, Arha, forever reborn. A single soul reincarnated endlessly and so immortal. I do believe that when I die, I will, like any mortal being, rejoin the greater being of the world. Like the grass, the trees, the animals. Men are only animals that speak, sir, as you said this morning.
But we can speak the language of the making, the wizard protested. By learning the words by which Segoy made the world, the very speech of life, we teach our souls to conquer death. That place where nothing is but dust and shadows, is that your conquest?
Her voice was not dry now, and her eyes flashed. Onyx stood indignant, but wordless. The king intervened.
Lord Sparrowhawk asked a second question, he said. Can a dragon cross the wall of stones?
He looked at Tehanu.
It's answered in the first answer, she said.
If dragons are only animals that speak, and animals don't go there. Has a mage ever seen a dragon there? Or you, my lord?
She looked first at Onyx, then at Labanan. Onyx pondered only a moment before he said, No.
The king looked amazed.
How is it I never thought of that? He said.
No, we saw none. I think there are no dragons there.
My lord, Alder said, louder than he had ever said anything in the palace, there is a dragon here.
He was standing facing the window, and he pointed at it. They all turned. In the sky, above the Bay of Havner, they saw a dragon flying from the west. Its long, slow beating, veined wings shone red-gold. A curl of smoke drifted behind it for a moment in the hazy summer air.
Now, said the king, what room do I make ready for this guest?
He spoke as if amused, bemused. But the instant he saw the dragon turn and come wheeling in toward the Tower of the Sword, he ran from the room and down the stairs, startling and outstripping the guards in the halls and at the doors, so that he came out first and alone on the terrace under the White Tower. The terrace was the roof of a banquet hall, a wide expanse of marble with a low balustrade, the Sword Tower rising directly over it, and the Queen's Tower nearby. The dragon had alighted on the pavement and was furling its wings with a loud metallic rattle as the king came out. Where it came down, its talons had scratched grooves in the marble. The long gold-mailed head swung round. The dragon looked at the king. The king looked down and did not meet its eyes, but he stood straight and spoke clearly. Orm Irion, welcome. I am Labanan. Agni Labanan, said the great hissing voice, greeting him as Orm Embar had greeted him long ago, in the farthest west, before he was a king. Behind him, Onyx and Tehanu had run out onto the terrace along with several guards. One guard had his sword out, and Labanan saw, in the window of the Queen's Tower, another with drawn bow and notched arrow aimed at the dragon's breast. Put down your weapons, he shouted in a voice that made the towers ring, and the guard obeyed in such haste that he nearly dropped his sword. But the archer lowered his bow reluctantly, finding it hard to leave his lord defenseless. Medeo, Tehanu whispered, coming up beside Labanan, her gaze unwavering on the dragon. The great creature's head swung round again,
and the immense amber eye in a socket of shining, wrinkled scales gazed back, unblinking. The dragon spoke. Onyx, understanding, murmured to the king what it said and what Tehanu replied. "Kalesin's daughter, my sister," it said. "You do not fly."
"I cannot change, sister," Tehanu said.
"Shall I?"
"For a while, if you will."
Then, those on the terrace and in the windows of the towers saw the strangest thing they might ever see, however long they lived in a world of sorceries and wonders. They saw the dragon, a huge creature whose scaled belly and thorny tail dragged and stretched half across the breadth of the terrace, and whose red-horned head reared up twice the height of the king. They saw it lower, that big head, and tremble, so that its wings rattled like cymbals, and not smoke, but a mist breathed out of its deep nostrils, clouding its shape, so that it became cloudy like thin fog or worn glass. And then it was gone. The midday sun beat down on the scored, scarred white pavement. There was no dragon. There was a woman. She stood some 10 paces from Tehanu and the king. She stood where the heart of the dragon might have been. She was young, tall, and strongly built, dark-haired, wearing a farm woman's shift and trousers, barefoot. She stood motionless, as if bewildered. She looked down at her body. She lifted up her hand and looked at it. "The little thing," she said, in the common speech. And she laughed. She looked at Tehanu. "It's like putting on the shoes I wore when I was 5, she said. The two women moved towards each other, with a certain stateliness, like that of armed warriors saluting or ships meeting at sea. They embraced. They held each other lightly, but for some moments they drew apart, and both turned to face the king. "Lady Irian," he said, and bowed. She looked a little nonplussed, and made a kind of country curtsy. When she looked up, he saw her eyes were the color of amber. He looked instantly away. "I'll do you no harm in this guise," she said, with a broad white smile. "Your Majesty," she added uncomfortably, trying to be polite. He bowed again. It was he that was nonplussed now. He looked at Tehanu and round at Tanar, who had come out onto the terrace with Alder. Nobody said anything. Irian's eyes went to Onyx, standing in his gray cloak just behind the king, and her face lighted up again. "Sir," she said, "are you from Roke Island? Do you know the Lord Patterner?" Onyx bowed, or nodded. He, too, kept his eyes from hers. "Is he well? Does he walk among his trees?" Again the wizard bowed. "And the doorkeeper, and the herbal, and Kurim Karmeruk. They befriended me. They stood by me. Ah, if you go back there, greet them with my love and honor, if you please." "I will," the wizard said.
"My mother is here," Tehanu said softly to Irian. "Tenar of Atuan."
"Tenar of Gaunt," Labanan said, with a certain ring to his voice. Looking with open wonder at Tanar, Irian said, "It was you that brought the rune ring from the land of the hoary men, along with the archmage." "It was," Tanar said, staring with equal frankness at Irian. Above them on the balcony that encircled the Tower of the Sword, near its summit, there was movement. The trumpeters had come out to sound the hour, but at the moment, all 4 of them were gathered on the south side overlooking the terrace, peering down to see the dragon. There were faces in every window of the palace towers, and the thrum of voices down in the streets could be heard like a tide coming in.
"When they sound the first hour," Labanon said, "the council will gather again. The councillors will have seen you come, my lady, or heard of your coming. So if it please you, I think it best that we go straight among them and let them behold you. And if you'll speak to them, I promise you they'll listen."
"Very well," Irian said. For a moment there was a ponderous, reptilian impassivity in her. When she moved, that vanished, and she seemed only a tall young woman who stepped forward quite awkwardly, saying with a smile to Tehanu, "I feel as if I'll float up like a spark. There's no weight to me." The four trumpets up in the tower sounded to the west, north, east, south in turn. One phrase of the lament a king 500 years ago had made for the death of his friend.